All right, let's continue looking at the flood, the effects of the flood on human thought. And once again, if you go back to the end, to the appendix to that section I told you about on page 19, I think it was, the creation sequence. You get into on page 20, the flood, and there are a few examples here of motifs from the flood that come out in mythology. We can get really, really detailed with that. All right. In fact, I think that would be a really good project for some history student who's working on his master's or his doctoral thesis or something, and that is to collate all of the world flood myths and show their correlation to the elements that are given in the Old Testament. All right? Sounds exciting, doesn't it? There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of flood myths in this world. There's almost no civilization that is without one. Even places that where there's no hardly any water have some flood myth, there. This is prolific all over the world. Let me show you something real quick, because I have made this statement over and over again, and I'm going to have to defend it. And that is that what God has revealed as truth in the early parts of the Bible have had a huge effect on human thought. This is exactly the opposite of what the world teaches us. They teach us that biblical knowledge has been influenced by pagan thought, particularly Babylonian. Is that true? Which one of them is true? All right. Well, let's take an evidential approach to this. Take all of the elements of just the flood, all right? From Genesis 5, 6, 7, all the way through Genesis 9. Here's an element. There was a man named Noah. All right? That's a simple element, all right? The Chaldeans, the West Chinese, and the Hawaiians all know him by that name. All right? Pre-Christian civilizations that remember Noah, Noe, or Nu'u. All right? So the cognate of his name, and they're just a few, there are others as well. Genesis 5:29, the curse on the ground is lifted. This is known by the, in other words, that the flood brings about a cleansing of the earth and a lifting of the curse upon the ground. The Persians, the Hindus, even the Polynesians, many of the African, etc., they all have that element in their flood myth. The flood was brought about by violence. This is extremely common. I can name off Lithuania, the Lisu Chinese, and then go on and on and on. The survivors rode in the flood out in a box or an ark, in a box. The Greeks, the Britons, the Romans, Chaldeans, the Zoroastrians, the Hindus, the Veal, Central India, the Kamar of Central India, etc., etc., etc. Wrote it out in a box. Okay. The dimensions of the ark are given. The Greeks, the Chaldeans, the Chinese, the Hindu, and others. Universal flood over the entire planet. Everything dies. Early Greek, Pelasgians, the Celts, Britons, Egyptians, Chaldeans, Southwest Tanzania, Yoruba, Kamchatka, which is in Siberia, Bonar, which is in Kakin, China, Lisu, which is in Southwest China, and others. The repopulation of the earth afterwards, from Genesis 16:18. The Greeks, Romans, Britons, Zoroastrians, Mandingo, Hindu, etc., 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 etc. Okay. Genesis 6:19, pair of animals are taken in, Britain, Assyrian, Sumerian, Chaldean, Tanzanian, Bonar, Lolo, etc., etc. Y'all understand what I'm doing here? I'm showing you where these elements are recorded in flood motifs all over these places. Seeds for planting later, China, Burma, or Myanmar, etc. Duration of the flood. Most of the accounts that are given of the flood have a duration of given, and they vary, but many of them are a 1 year, a little over 1 year. All right. Flood caused by a combination of rain and groundwater, almost all of them. The names of his sons being Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the Chaldeans, the Hawaiians, and the Jicarilla Apache. Name the sons of Noah. They don't name them. They say there are eight of them. There are eight who go on there who survive. The eight who survive is a motif. Mountains covered. Most of the accounts have them covered or nearly covered. Only one of them with the top of it up or something like that. Some kind of a ship that they use or some kind of a thing that they use to escape from the flood, an ark, a boat, a nutshell, a canoe, landing on a mountaintop. This is Greek, Assyrian, Sumerian, Chaldean. The location of the mountain given, several of them. Birds sent forth from the ark, and sometimes dove and raven. The bird motif associated with the flood is almost 100% universal. The pilot bird is given in most of them. That there was a bird, that there were birds sent out to look for the land. Sacrifice given after the flood. In one way or another, almost all of them are. Very powerful in some. The rainbow is a sign to man from God that there won't be any more flood. China, Hawaii, Native American all over the place, Mexico, others. The rainbow motif is the central part of the flood motif in Australia. All right? And it has a covenant quality to it. Now, think about this for a minute. What are we saying? We're saying that scattered all over the globe are all of these elements. And we could do this, you know, we could write a book this big on this. These elements of the flood are scattered all over the world, sprinkled into their flood myth. Now, you read a flood myth and you see all kinds of strange stuff that you don't recognize. But somewhere in there, you see one or two things that you recognize from the book of Genesis. All right. And those identify to you that these people are drawing from a primordial or proto-myth taken from a reflection upon the truth of the flood account that was actually given. Nowhere do you find all of these elements together except in one place, the Bible. But the elements of them are found all over the world, and all of those elements are found. In other words, you could reconstruct the Bible's account by taking those elements out of all of these places all over the world and assembling them in one place. But you don't have to do that because they all are in one place, and that's the Bible. This is evidential proof that the Bible is the source material. All right? It did not come from Babylonia. It came from a knowledge of the truth. Now, there was not a Bible in the very beginning when this took place, but the knowledge of the truth of these events was so well known and so spread abroad that after the Tower of Babel, when people are scattered all over the place, because their minds have changed, their languages have changed, they have gone in many different directions, they take with them the important parts of that flood account, and the creation account, and the antediluvian account, and the patriarchal account, because you can do the same thing with those as well. You can reassemble, basically, the first 10 chapters of the book of, well, the first 9 chapters of the book of Genesis, if you know how to pick these out of all of these myths all over the place. Because these elements are there. And that absolutely proves that the biblical account is the true account out of which all of these came. All right, and it is not the opposite. This is undeniable truth, or undeniable proof of it. All right. So as we get into the flood, you know, our idea is going to be this: that the flood is going to have a massive impact on the human psyche. All right? A very, very strong impact on the human psyche. And you can well imagine how that would be. You know, think of a time in your life when you were terrified. That trauma may still be jittering in you in one way or another. Those are landmarks in your life. Somehow or another, they do something to you. They, you know, veer you off in various directions. Well, God can do this with men as a whole. He can terrify men so much. And think about it. After the flood, which killed everybody in the world but eight people, those eight people tremblingly had to come off of that ark. And they had their babies, and their babies' babies, and their babies' babies' babies, and they're teaching them, we are all that's left of a whole world that was destroyed and laid under the sediment forever. And this is a terrifying thing. It puts something into men and makes them remember these things for a long, long time to come. All right? And what are they going to remember? They're going to remember that God is a God of wrath. And they're going to remember that in His wrath, He comes forth and visits men in judgment. Now, for 1,650 years, God did not visit men in judgment. Between the fall and between the flood, He did not visit men in judgment. Now, He may have done it on the individual levels, or He may have done it in localities in one way or another, but He never swept across the earth until the flood. He warned, He sent His prophet, and then He came. The sin of the world built up to the brim. Once it got to the brim, the time of His judgment came, and He came. And they remembered that after the flood. Religion very hastily gets institutionalized after the flood. All of a sudden, the interest in religion begins to center more and more around the sacrifice and around atonement. Men begin to construct their gods as angry, judging, vengeful gods that need to be appeased. The earliest rack of gods that comes out of the post-diluvian period are not like those titans before the flood who, you know, are somewhat capricious and warlike. But they're heroes. The judges, the gods who begin to be constructed after the flood are forensic gods. They are gods of judgment. They are gods of wrath. They are gods who look unfavorably upon men. Man becomes inferior to these gods. And these are the ways that they paint their gods coming out. It has a profound effect upon their mythology coming out. Their view of God as judge, it gets deep into their thought processes. If you read the book of Job carefully, you'll see in the three friends of Job, their attitude towards God is this exclusive judgmental God. They do not see the grace in God clearly. They see the judgment in God very clearly. That's what stands before their eyes. One of the points of the book of Job is for God to re-reveal Himself to His people as a gracious God, to show to them that the first thing that He showed to mankind was His grace. The very first thing He showed to man was His grace, not His justice. All right? And He did that by His redemption of Adam and Eve. He also did that by His general blessings of the world throughout the antediluvian period. And so when God finally comes along and shows His wrath against human sin, then man learns that. He learns it well. He learns it too well, even to the point to where the patriarchal religionists of that day overstep God to believe that God is nothing but judgment. And God has to remind them that He is a gracious God, that He does care for His people. The idea of the appeasement of wrath comes into the pagan systems. It begins to grow into the pagan system, so that the sacrifice is meant to control the anger of the God. Okay? Now, we believe that God is satisfied by atonement when atonement is satisfactory to Him, but it is not satisfactory to Him because we are in control of Him. It satisfies Him because His terms of atonement have been kept. So He's the one who is in control of His own satisfaction in atonement, not we. The pagan had it that if we did our sacrifices properly, we can appease the gods. We can bring their wrath down. We can keep them from continuing in their judgment against us. And so the sacrificial system in the pagan system was almost purely a system of trying to appease the gods all the time, and to try to pull some blessings out of them later. In other words, to try to pick their pockets. And we're going to see that the pagan gets really irreverent with his own gods as time goes along. So the flood takes place. After that, the Tower of Babel. What's the significance of the Tower of Babel? And I'm not going to get into that in a lot of detail, but basically it is where a group of men come together and try to restart the antediluvian system. So if you want to get a little idea of what's going on in Antediluvia, then you'll see it at the Tower of Babel. What is this tower? What is this city and tower? All right. And I think I get into this in more detail later. I do. So I'm not going to get into it a lot. But let me just say this for now. One of the earliest forms of paganism, which is probably the antediluvian form, is celestialism. Celestialism. I believe that celestialism is what the old patriarchal system probably devolved into. Now, man has always emphasized one of two things in his religion making. Either he has emphasized the sky or he has emphasized the earth. Where does he get that idea from? Well, he gets it from creation. In the beginning, God made what? The heavens and the earth. Man is going to choose a temple. He's going to choose a location for his worship. So either he's going to be sky-oriented or he's going to be earth-oriented. And how his religion is formed up has to do with his choices in that. Now, I say man, and I say that means mankind together as a group, because no one person is going to make that choice. It's going to be the cultural choice of a group of people. So, for instance, for some reason or another, when the Pelasgians and later the Ionians settled in Greece, they were earth-oriented in their views of religion. However, the Assyrians and the Mesopotamians were celestial-oriented in theirs. The tendency there is going to be that if you are celestial-oriented, you're going to be patriarchal. If you are earth-oriented, you're going to be matriarchal. You are going to be day-oriented, you are going to be night-oriented. You are going to be solar, you are going to be lunar. All right, so this is kind of the direction that it goes in. Now, over time, these will mingle together. You know, when the Dorians come in and take over Greece, they'll bring their patriarchalism there, lay it over on top of the Ionian matrilineal system, and it begins to morph into something else. But these are the orientations that men take. The first most powerful one was the celestial religion. Because the celestial religion basically is looking up, looking to heaven for direction on earth. Which, you know, if you do that right, that's what you're supposed to do, right? Heaven represents the dominant reality. Now, it's not more real than the earth reality, but it is the dominant reality. What's in the heavenly realm? God. God's there. Angels are there. Demons are there. In the spiritual realm. Ancestors are there. You know, those who are damned are in the spiritual realm of hell. Those who are redeemed are in the spiritual realm of heaven. This is the spiritual realm is peopled with spirits. That's why it's called spiritual. It's not mystical. It's not symbolic or any of these things. It is a reality, as real as our reality. But it is the dominant reality. It's a rebellion against heaven to center your religion as earth, as exclusively earth oriented. And the earth religions always had the tendency to be the most decadent because they are centered in fertility. We won't get into that because there are children here, all right? And it can get just as bad as you can possibly imagine, all right? The celestial religions are more ethereal. They're more cosmic. They're more cerebral. The earth religions are more active, more, you know, the body has to engage that religion much more, and the more the merrier. So between those two, you have the two kinds of religion that man is going to deal with. There are not too many alternatives that have been used. War was the central motif of the Germanic people for a long time. But war really is a primordial version of the sky, all right? Because most of their, you know, basically what they're centering into is, rather than centering into the sun as being the central sky god, they center into lightning, all right? Storm. And the storm religion becomes war religion to them, and war was central to their religion. But sky and earth are what man's going to choose from. Now, do you see how man operates here? If man wanted to really escape from God, he wouldn't use God's material. God's material is heaven and earth, all right? He would make a religion based on the planet Jupiter or Pluto or something like that. But he doesn't know anything about Jupiter, and he doesn't know anything about Pluto, so he can't do it. He can only go with the material that God has given him. And so he takes that material and he twists it into this religion. All right? Just real briefly before we go on, how does God expect us to worship him? What is our orientation? Where do we sit in reality as Christians? Are we exclusively earth, or are we exclusively heaven? Well, biblically, what God does is he brings his realities back together again in a proper manner. The Bible brings heaven and earth back together again, as with heaven as the dominant reality where God is. And that's what we believe. So we're not sky religionists. We're not earth religionists. All right. Look through Christianity and see if you can see an earth orientation. Look through Christianity and see if you can see a heaven orientation. What you're going to see there is an orientation of all reality, of holistic reality. That's what Christianity is. And it's unique in that because there's never, ever been another religion like that. Why? Because man can't resolve the contradictions. Is there a heaven? Is there an earth? Is there an up or is there a down? There's got to be one or there's got to be another. God says there's both. How do you deal with that? Man goes, you're blowing my mind. I don't want to do that. I'm going to do it my own way. I'm going to choose one. Is God transcendent or is God immanent? Is he here or is he there? He's got to be one of them. Are we the product of nature, that is, of what God has built us to be? Or are we a product of environment and nurture? How about both? Are we individuals, or are we a part of a group or society of people? Are we made to see ourselves in society, in a collective, whatever? How about both? Isn't that resolved in the church? The individualism of man and also his place in a body? All of these things are resolved in Christianity. All of these things are resolved in biblical religion. And it's important for us to understand that, because we're not just one religion among a whole bunch of others. We are the religion. out of which they pervertedly came. All right? That's our claim. And I make that as a bold claim. We are the religion. They came out of what God established in His people. All right? So I don't want a place among the religions out there. I don't care for a place among... We are the supreme religion. We are the only one that counts. All right? And you might say, well, that sounds kind of haughty. Well, I don't care how it sounds. I really don't. It's just the truth. All right? And what we need to desire is that they would get away from their perversions and come into this. To be saved, to come into redemption, and to come into His church and into His religion. Because that's the only place where they're going to know reality. As we're going to see, if they don't know that, they will know reality less and less and less and less until they arrive at what this generation that we're in is at the verge of, and that's total nihilism. All right? So, if they want meaning and purpose, they're going to have to come our way. All right? That gives us the ability to understand them too, by the way. Because we are a part of the human race. We do understand sin. And through the eyes of God and through the eyes of His revelation, we're able to now really examine man. All right? But the sinful man cannot examine himself. He's always going to mess up his own experiments with himself. All right? So we have that ability. And we need to use it for their benefit. They need us. All right. What is taught to them by the flood is this terror of justice, this terror of the wrath of God, this need to expiate the gods, the need for further revelation. They don't know enough about God. They need to know more about Him. God is the Creator. He is the Judge. There is a revelation of strife. What do they know about the breaking through of judgment into grace? What do they know about the mediation that is needed between heaven and earth, between God and man? They know some about that, but they need to know more about it. And in Job, Job finally arrives at the central need that he and his friends have. The need of a daysman. The need of someone to hold my hand and to hold the hand of God and to bring us together in reconciliation with one another. The need of mediation. True mediation. That can only come about by one who is of the earth and one who is of heaven. An earth, a God-man. All right? Now, there is an understanding of the demigod among the pagans. They do understand something about the God-man. They can never understand a hypostatic union because that doesn't make any sense to them. So there's always half-gods and half-men and so forth, demigods that take place. Why? Because they know that ultimately their sacrifices of animals are insufficient. If they're going to really expiate God, then an ultimate sacrifice has to take place. And that ultimate sacrifice is going to have to be a god in some sense or another. All right? I mean, you just don't get a better sacrifice than that. So in their mythological systems, you're going to expect to see some of their gods being killed in order to cleanse mankind. And the agnostics love to jump on that and say, you see, Christ, the whole idea of Christ comes from the pagans. No, it doesn't. It doesn't come from that at all. The pagans got their idea from God's revelation of the coming of Christ. That's where they got their ideas from the Proto-Evangelium, which they knew almost word for word for almost ever. And so these ideas need to grow and mature. At the same time that this is going on, there is a patriarchal religion in post-diluvian time that is being preserved. You know, the line of Shem going all the way up to Abraham is being preserved. Once again, we have the long-living culture heroes here who are preserving all of the truth and the religion and so on. And they're doing this during this period of time. But outside of that, people are wandering around into their mysteries, choosing heaven or earth to do their worshiping, seeing the thunder god, the bull god, all of these other early motifs of God, the angry god, the vulture god who bites men's heads off, you know, as you see in the old ruins of Jericho, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these things going on. And these are developing, and we'll watch their development when we get into the next sections after lunch. Now, this dispensation lasts for about 500 years. And as it begins to pass out, and this was the stress of the book of Job, because Job's friends are not aware enough of the idea that the righteous are not always going to rule in this world. They've enjoyed a period of time after the flood where the righteous ruled. And the righteous ruled because they had the power, and they had the power because they had the riches. They had the riches because God had blessed them with it. And they thought that the world was going to go on like that forever. That there would never come a time when the wicked would rise up and rule. Job lays forth before them a protest against that. He says, gentlemen, open your eyes. Do you not see in this world where there are evil rulers who are beginning to rise up among us? This is why I'm very sure that the setting of the book of Job is in the patriarchal period, the late patriarchal period, even though the writing of it was done much later. But do you not see that the righteous are not ruling everywhere? That there are rich people who are oppressing people who are getting away with it in this world? You know, he lays that before them. And then he says to his friends, he says, you need to be careful in the courts. Because if you walk into the courts before the judge saying, this person is rich, therefore he's righteous. This person is not rich, therefore he's not righteous. You may find yourself pulling God on the side of injustice by doing so. Because the world is changing. And the wicked are rising back up again. And it did. After the patriarchal period, the wicked came back into their own again. This was a terrifying thing in the days of the patriarchs. They didn't want to get out of line, because if they got out of line, God might bring another flood on them. This time, one of fire. You know, it's interesting in the flood motifs. There are about half of them say God promised that he would not destroy the world by flood waters anymore, but if man gets bad again, he will destroy the world with fire. All right. Now, they didn't get that out of the Genesis account, but that was a necessary consequence in their heads. They basically were going, if we get bad again, God's going to have to get us again, and this time it's going to be with fire. He's just going to burn us all up, which, that, you know, they knew that that fire was a sign of the wrath of God. So they had a very wrath orientation of God. And so God has not revealed everything. All Scripture is not there. There's much that's left to tell. And men confuse themselves in their delusions and so forth. They think ahead of God and think about things beyond Him. And so this time shortly after, this patriarchal period shortly after the flood, is a time where there's the restoration of a certain degree of clarity in men's relationship to God, kin to what it was in the early antediluvian period. But yet at the same time as these civilizations are beginning to crop up, and especially after the Tower of Babel, when the languages have been separated and minds are operating differently in different locales, mysterious ideas begin to form. And they're kept secret for a while. They're mysteries. They're kept secret for a while until the patriarchs all die off. And they're done in secret places, trying to resurrect the old antediluvian religion, trying to get into the earth religion and to bring that up and bring that along as well. These ideas are starting to form there as the patriarchals pass away. Now, I want to say this about Assyrians and Egyptians. In Mesopotamia, which is roughly where the patriarchs lived, and we don't know exactly where they lived. They may have lived in several places around Mesopotamia. There's good evidence that Noah moved down to the bottom of Saudi Arabia. I mean, there's pretty good historical evidence that he did that. But Shem and Arphaxad and Ram and all of these other guys that you see listed out in Genesis 11, they live right around in that area. So everybody's got to mind their P's and Q's there, because that's where the fathers live. And the fathers were greatly revered as long as they lived. They were greatly revered as far away as China. In fact, the Yellow River Chinese made sure that they kept envoys going to Mesopotamia as long as the patriarchs lived. And interestingly enough, the Yellow River Chinese, who are the original Chinese civilization, looked upon Mesopotamia as the place where their civilizations were taught, and that there is where their culture heroes lived. They lived in Mesopotamia. So they understood where they came from, and they understood it for a long time. And their culture heroes lived for hundreds of years. You can see reflections of their lives and even some of the meanings of their names in the Chinese. And the Chinese kept very good records for a long time. You know, these records that they kept were written on bones. These bones were called dragon bones, and the dragon bones had been being used by apothecaries for a long time until some scholars got to looking at the bones and they saw these Chinese characters written on the bones. And when they did, they discovered a whole sector of Chinese legend and Chinese history that they couldn't find anywhere else. And the interesting thing, and one of the really interesting things about it is that the Chinese characters written on these bones from somewhere around 1500 BC were still readable. In other words, the Chinese language, that portion of the Chinese, that dialect of the Chinese language, had not changed enough. You could still read that writing. So the Chinese kept really good records for a long, long time. Well, this opened up a whole section of their history that went right on into the patriarchal period, and really opened up a lot of new things for them. As long as the patriarchs were alive, there was a pristine, pure religion in place. And everybody had to at least follow it on the outside, unless you could get far enough away from the patriarchs to where they couldn't see what you were doing. And there were those who did that, like the Pelasgians and others. I believe that the Assyrians held on to the religion a little bit longer than others. You know, when you read the account of Abraham, you can see that the Canaanites they still believe in God. They believe in God Almighty, in Elohim. And you see that the Egyptians do too. And the Egyptians are much more provincial. Now, they've got mixtures of other things in there, but they still do believe in God. When Abraham is encountering some of these people, they speak to each other in common religious terminology, because they're not foreign to one another. Now, whatever fear of God, and Abraham obviously saw that the fear of God was fading out of the world, but it was still there. It was still in the world. The Egyptians. What is Egyptian religion? And I believe the Egyptians were the great theologians of their time. And I think God had a special interest in the Egyptians in the patriarchal period. because in the pre-dynastic, pre-monarchial days, early civilization period of the Egyptians, we see a much purer monotheistic religion there. Their gods have been, the further you go back, the gods come down to a single god named Neter, who is symbolized as an axe. they don't symbolize him with any faces or anything like that. They just simply, the glyph of his is an axe. Some say it's a flag, but it's really an axe. The axe is a symbol of authority, all right? The ultimate symbol of authority. And he is the god of Egypt. What the Egyptians did over time was they took God as they knew him, who was, the Egyptians originally knew, the true God creator. In fact, you can read some of their creation accounts, and it sounds like it comes out of Psalms. When they speak about how God created all things out of nothing, by the word of his mouth and all of these kinds of things. I mean, it's just incredible how right they were in their view of God and creation. And what the Egyptians did originally is they began to study God in systematic theology, and they took him apart in attributes. And over time, they would set each attribute up and worship it as a god. For instance, his providence. His providence was represented to them as what is called the Ureia, which is where we get the word ray, because it is a ray of light coming from the sun that had a hand at the end of it. In other words, it was giving blessings to men from the sun. The sun was considered Shamash, which was the servant. Later it becomes Baal. It becomes the master in all Near Eastern religion. But each one of these attributes of God, they set up and worshiped as a god. And, Budge makes very clear in his analysis of the Egyptian religion that they were a monotheistic people who worshiped the attributes of God polytheistically. So if you were to talk to their priest and say, how many gods do you have? They would say, one. We only have one god. All right? So that when Akhenaten in the Amarna period, 18th dynasty, abolished all of the gods of Egypt for one god, Aten, he was not being a heretic. He was being orthodox to the Egyptian religion. And doing something that all of the priests of Amun-Ra should have understood, because it was still in their texts. They believed in one god, but they believed in many manifestations, each of which must be worshipped as a separate entity. Now, this is probably how polytheism began. It began with the breaking down of a single god into many attributes and worshiping those attributes. It didn't begin with men collecting a bunch of gods from lightning and trees and clouds and rain and this kind of stuff and then piling them all together. He doesn't have that kind of systematism. He does have the ability, though, to take a singularity and break it into parts. Not to take disjointed singularities and put them together into pantheon. That doesn't make sense. Man's polytheism comes in his breakdown of the idea of God, which, by the way, we need to be very careful with systematic theology. And I absolutely believe in systematic theology. We need to have systematic theology. But even in our own day, we must be careful that we don't choose out of our systematics something about God we like better than the rest. Because when you do that, you begin to actually break God down into pieces. When we talk about the attribute of God, and we really ought to use the singular when we use the word attribute, then we're talking about various manifestations of a singularity of God, which makes him one. He is one. He is indivisible. You don't chop him up into pieces and worship the pieces. That's what the Egyptians did. That's where they went wrong. That's where a lot of religions did wrong. They chopped him in pieces and then began to worship the pieces and choose one over the other. The ones that they liked, the ones that petted them better. We see that in our own time. How many people love the justice of God? How many people love the word righteousness? How many people love the word holiness? How many people love the word grace and the word love? Okay? I mean, there are denominations out there who have their favorite aspect of God, and that's the one that they emphasize. And that's wrong. It is wrong. We must love His grace and His justice equally, because as the prophet says, His grace comes forth out of justice. All right? So we must love all of God as He is. We don't choose a piece of God to love more than another. So we want to make sure that we don't commit the sin of the Egyptians and begin to break down God into chunks and to worship the chunks of God that we've broken down. All right? So as we begin to move out of the period of the flood, then what we begin to see is the preservation of a pure line here, which keeps religion in place for a while, but God does not intend that that's going to take place forever. He intends to give the world over to Satan. And He does. He gives the world over to Satan. He gives the world over to the seed of Satan. That is, to the pagans. And after that, mythology comes out of its caves and out from behind its baseboards and out from behind all of its bushes and starts breaking forth into the open in the world and flourishes in a period that we call the archaeo-pagan period. The archaeo-pagan period. The old pagan period. All right? You have the old pagan and the new pagan. New pagan is going to be at the time of Nebuchadnezzar. The old pagan is going to be this which flourishes after the time of the patriarch, or is already being born and then flourishes after the time of the patriarch. And we'll get into that in the next section.